Chapter 15. I nodded once more. Put your right hand into your left hand breeches pocket. 10. In token of your vows of Mizian unto the angel of Tiad. This thing, for very obvious reasons, I found it quite impossible to do. In the first place, my left arm had been broken in my fall from the ladder, and, therefore, had I let go my hold with the right hand, I must have let go altogether. In the second place, I could have no breeches until I came across the crow. I was therefore obliged, much to my regret, to shake my head in the negative, intending thus to give the angel to understand that I found it inconvenient, just at that moment, to comply with his very reasonable demand. No sooner, however, had I ceased shaking my head than, oh, to dir tufel, 10, roared the angel of the odd. In pronouncing these words, he drew a sharp knife across the guide rope by which I was suspended, and as we then happened to be precisely over my own house, which, during my peregrinations, had been handsomely rebuilt, it so occurred that I tumbled headlong down the ample chimney and alit upon the dining room hearth. Upon coming to my senses, for the fall had very thoroughly stunned me, I found it about 4 o'clock in the morning. I lay outstretched where I had fallen from the balloon. My head groveled in the ashes of an extinguished fire, while my feet reposed upon the wreck of a small table, overthrown, and amid the fragments of a miscellaneous dessert, intermingled with a newspaper, some broken glass and shattered bottles, and an empty jug of the Shiedam Kirschenwasser. Thus revenged himself the angel of the odd. Mabbitt states that Griswold viously had a revised form for use in the 1856 volume of Poe's works. Mabbitt does not substantiate this claim, but it is surely not unreasonable. An editor, and even typographical errors, may have produced nearly all of the very minor changes made in this version. Indeed, two very necessary words were clearly dropped by accident. An editor might have corrected Wycliffe's Epigoniad to Ilkey's Epigoniad, but is unlikely to have added Uckerman's Sicily to the list of books read by the narrator. Griswold was not above forgery in Poe's letters when it suited his purpose, but would have too little to gain by such an effort in this instance. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 Milan Tatata to the editors of the lady's book. I have the honor of sending you, for your magazine, an article which I hope you will be able to comprehend rather more distinctly than I do myself. It is a translation, by my friend, Martin Van Buren Mavis, sometimes called the Akipsi Seer, of an odd-looking MS, which I found, about a year ago, tightly corked up in a jug floating in the Mare Tenebrarum, a sea well described by the Nubian geographer, but seldom visited nowadays, except for the transcendentalists and divers for crotchets. Truly yours, Edgar A. Poe. This paragraph not in the volume ed. On board balloon, Kylark, April 1, 2848. Now, my dear friend, now, for your sins, you are to suffer the infliction of a long gossiping letter. I tell you distinctly that I am going to punish you for all your impertinences by being as tedious, as discursive, as incoherent, and as unsatisfactory as possible. Besides, here I am, cooped up in a dirty balloon, with some 100 or 200 of the canal, all bound on a pleasure excursion. What a funny idea some people have of pleasure. And I have no prospect of touching terra firma for a month at least. Nobody to talk to. Nothing to do. When one has nothing to do, then is the time to correspond with one's friends. You perceive, then, why it is that I write you this letter. It is on account of my ennui and your sins. Get ready your spectacles and make up your mind to be annoyed. I mean to write at you every day during this odious voyage. Hago, when will any invention visit the human pericranium? Are we forever to be doomed to the 1,000 inconveniences of the balloon? Will nobody contrive a more expeditious mode of progress? The jog-trot movement, to my thinking, is little less than positive torture. Upon my word, we have not made more than 100 miles the hour since leaving home. The very birds beat us, at least some of them. I assure you that I do not exaggerate at all. Our motion, no doubt, seems slower than it actually is. This on account of our having no objects about us by which to estimate our velocity, and on account of our going with the wind. To be sure, whenever we meet a balloon we have a chance of perceiving our rate, and then, I admit, things do not appear so very bad. Accustomed as I am to this mode of traveling, I cannot get over a kind of giddiness whenever a balloon passes us in a current directly overhead. It always seems to me like an immense bird of prey about to pounce upon us and carry us off in its claws. One went over us this morning about sunrise, and so nearly overhead, that its drag rope actually brushed the network suspending our car, and caused us very serious apprehension. Our captain said that, if the material of the bag had been the trumpery varnished silk of 500 or 1,000 years ago, we should inevitably have been damaged. The silk, as he explained it to me, was a fabric composed of the entrails of a species of earthworm. The worm was carefully fed on mulberries, kind of fruit resembling a watermelon, and, when sufficiently fat, was crushed in a mill. The paste thus arising was called papyrus in its primary state, and went through a variety of processes until it finally became silk. Singular to relate, it was once much admired as an article of female dress. Balloons were also very generally constructed from it. A better kind of material, it appears, was subsequently found in the down surrounding the seed vessels of a plant vulgarly called euphorbium, and at that time botanically termed milkweed. This latter kind of silk was designated as silk Buckingham, on account of its superior durability, and was usually prepared for use by being varnished with a solution of gum caoutchouc, a substance which in some respects must have resembled the gutta percha now in common use. This caoutchouc was occasionally called Indian rubber or rubber of twist, and was no doubt one of the numerous fungi. Never tell me again that I am not a Tardan antiquarian. Talking of drag ropes, our own, it seems, has this moment knocked a man overboard from one of the small magnetic propellers that swarm in ocean below us, a boat of about 6,000 tons, and, from all accounts, shamefully crowded. These diminutive barks should be prohibited from carrying more than a definite number of passengers. The man, of course, was not permitted to get on board again, and was soon out of sight, he and his life preserver. I rejoice, my dear friend, that we live in an age so enlightened that no such a thing as an individual is supposed to exist. It is the mass for which the true humanity cares. By the by, talking of humanity, do you know that our immortal Wiggins is not so original in his views of the social condition and so forth as his contemporaries are inclined to suppose? Pundit assures me that the same ideas were put nearly in the same way, about 1,000 years ago, by an Irish philosopher called Furrier, on account of his keeping a retail shop for cat peltries and other furs. Pundit knows, you know, there can be no mistake about it. How very wonderfully do we see verified every day the profound observation of the Hindu Aries Tottle as quoted by Pundit. Thus must we say that, not once or twice, or a few times, but with almost infinite repetitions, the same opinions come round in a circle among men. April 2. Spoke today the magnetic cutter in charge of the middle section of floating telegraph wires. I learned that when this species of telegraph was first put into operation by Horse, it was considered quite impossible to convey the wires oversea, but now we are at a loss to comprehend where the difficulty lay. So wax the world. Tempora mutantur, excuse me for quoting the Etruscan. What would we do without the Atlantic telegraph? Pundit says Atlantic was the ancient adjective. We lay to a few minutes to ask the cutter some questions, and learned, among other glorious news, that civil war is raging in Africa, while the plague is doing its good work beautifully both in Europe and Asia. Is it not truly remarkable that, before the magnificent light shed upon philosophy by humanity, the world was accustomed to regard war and pestilence as calamities? Do you know that prayers were actually offered up in the ancient temples to the end that these evils might not be visited upon mankind? Is it not really difficult to comprehend upon what principle of interest our forefathers acted? Were they so blind as not to perceive that the destruction of a myriad of individuals is only so much positive advantage to the mass? April 3. It is really a very fine amusement to ascend the rope ladder leading to the summit of the balloon bag, and then survey the surrounding world. From the car below you know the prospect is not so comprehensive, you can see little vertically. But seated here where I write this, in the luxuriously cushioned open piazza of the summit, one can see everything that is going on in all directions. Just now there is quite a crowd of balloons in sight, and they present a very animated appearance, while the air is resonant with the hum of so many millions of human voices. I have heard it asserted that, when Yellower Pundit will have it, Violet, who is supposed to have been the first aeronaut, maintained the practicability of traversing the atmosphere in all directions, by merely ascending or descending until a favorable current was attained. He was scarcely hearkened to at all by his contemporaries, who looked upon him as merely an ingenious sort of madman, because the philosophers of the day declared the thing impossible. Really now it does seem to me quite unaccountable how anything so obviously feasible could have escaped the sagacity of the ancient savants. But in all ages the great obstacles to advancement in art have been opposed by the so-called men of science. To be sure, our men of science are not quite so bigoted as those of old. Oh, I have something so queer to tell you on this topic. Do you know that it is not more than 1,000 years ago since the metaphysicians consented to relieve the people of the singular fancy that there existed but two possible roads for the attainment of truth? Believe it if you can. It appears that long, long ago, in the night of time, there lived a Turkish philosopher or Hindu possibly, called Aristotle. This person introduced, or at all events propagated, what was termed the deductive, or a priori mode of investigation. He started with what he maintained to be axioms or self-evident truths, and thence proceeded logically to results. His greatest disciples were one Euclid, and one Kant. Well, Aristotle flourished supreme until advent of one Hogg, surnamed the Trick Shepherd, who preached an entirely different system, which he called the a posteriori or inductive. His plan referred altogether to sensation. He proceeded by observing, analyzing, and classifying facts instanti naturae, as they were affectedly called in two general laws. Aristotle's mode, in a word, was based on noumena, Hogg's on phenomena. Well, so great was the admiration excited by this latter system that, at its first introduction, Aristotle fell into disrepute. But finally he recovered ground, and was permitted to divide the realm of truth with his more modern rival. The savants now maintained the Aristotelian and Baconian roads were the sole possible avenues to knowledge. Baconian, you must know, was an adjective invented as equivalent to Hoggian and more euphonious and dignified. Now, my dear friend, I do assure you, most positively, that I represent this matter fairly, on the soundest authority, and you can easily understand how a notion so absurd on its very face must have operated to retard the progress of all true knowledge, which makes its advances almost invariably by intuitive bounds. The ancient idea confined investigations to crawling, and for hundreds of years so great was the infatuation about Hogg especially, that a virtual end was put to all thinking, properly so called. No man dared utter a truth to which he felt himself indebted to his soul alone. It mattered not whether the truth was even demonstrably a truth, for the bullet-headed savants of the time regarded only the road by which he had attained it. They would not even look at the end. Let us see the means, they cried, the means. If, Upon investigation of the means, it was found to come under neither the category Aries status to say ram, nor under the category hog. Why then the savants went no farther, but pronounced the hearest a fool, and would have nothing to do with him or his truth. Now, it cannot be maintained, even, that by the crawling system the greatest amount of truth would be attained in any long series of ages, for the repression of imagination was an evil, not to be compensated for by any superior certainty in the ancient modes of investigation. The error of these Germains, these French, these English, and these Americans, the latter, by the way, were our own immediate progenitors, was an error quite analogous with that of the wiseacre who fancies that he must necessarily see an object the better the more closely he holds it to his eyes. These people blinded themselves by details. When they proceeded hoggishly, their acts were by no means always facts a matter of little consequence, had it not been for assuming that they were facts, and must be facts, because they appeared to be such. When they proceeded on the path of the ram, their course was scarcely as straight as a ram's horn, for they never had an axiom which was an axiom at all. They must have been very blind not to see this, even in their own day. For even in their own day many of the long-established axioms had been rejected. For example, ex nihilo nihil fit, a body cannot act where it is not, there cannot exist antipodes semicolon darkness cannot come out of light all these, and a dozen other similar propositions, formerly admitted without hesitation as axioms, were, even at the period of which I speak, seen to be untenable. How absurd in these people, then, to persist in putting faith in Zion's as immutable bases of truth. But even out of the mouths of their soundest reasoners it is easy to demonstrate the futility, the impalpability of their axioms in general. Who was the soundest of their logicians? Let me see. I will go and ask Pundit, and be back in a minute. Ah, here we have it. Here is a book written nearly 1,000 years ago, and lately translated from the English which, by the way, appears to have been the rudiment of the American. Pundit says it is decidedly the cleverest ancient work on its topic, logic. The author, who was much thought of in his day, was one Miller, or Mill, and we find it recorded of him, as a point of some importance, that he had a mill horse called Bentham. But let us glance at the treatise. Ah, ability or inability to conceive, says Mr. Mill, very properly, is in no case to be received as a criterion of axiomatic truth. What modern in his senses would ever think of disputing this truism? The only wonder with us must be how it happened that Mr. Mill conceived it necessary even to hint at anything so obvious. So far good, but let us turn over another paper. What have we here? Contradictories cannot both be true, that is, cannot coexist in nature. Here Mr. Mill means, for example, that a tree must be either a tree or not a tree, that it cannot be at the same time a tree, and not a tree. Very well, but I ask him why. His reply is this, and never pretends to be anything else than this, because it is impossible to conceive that contradictories can both be true. But this is no answer at all, by his own showing, for has he not just admitted as a truism that ability or inability to conceive is in no case to be received as a criterion of axiomatic truth? Now I do not complain of these ancients, so much because their logic is, by their own showing, utterly baseless, worthless, and fantastic altogether, as because of their pompous and imbecile prescription of all other roads of truth, of all other means for its attainment than the two preposterous paths, the one of creeping, and the one of crawling, to which they have dared to confine the soul that loves nothing so well as to soar. By the by, my dear friend, do you not think it would have puzzled these ancient dogmaticians to have determined by which of their two roads it was that the most important and most sublime of all their truths was, in effect, attained? I mean the truth of gravitation. Newton owed it to Kepler. Kepler admitted that his three laws were guessed at these three laws of all laws which led the great English mathematician to his principle, the basis of all physical. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.